For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to All My Best Friends Are Digital, a podcast about video games and the stories they tell. With me is Caitlin Bailey. How are you doing, Caitlin?
I am wonderful. How about you, Mark?
I would be wonderful too, Caitlin. I saw the picture that you sent me of your burgeoning setup with all of your retro consoles. And I gotta say, despite the fact that between the two of us, I seem to be the one with more enthusiasm for retro games, your hardware setup has me envious. That is beautiful.
So I've been wanting to have all of my old consoles actually set up so I can play them instead of see them in a closet and feel guilty every now and then.
Wild thought.
This is my first step toward getting everything set up where I can play it all on my TV and start to enjoy the stuff that I've been collecting since, you know, I was in high school. So I'm really excited.
I would encourage you to post pictures copiously on social media so we can see the progress.
Yeah, I will.
I have personally encouraged Caitlin to add the Neo Geo Gold that I bequeathed to your husband some years ago, because I am not in a position of being able to store all this stuff. And so I've had to divest myself of all my old style hardware. The only thing that I've kept is my arcade cabinet, which I built myself. So I guess that's your next step too. But you're not really an arcade gamer, so.
Yeah, that one might be a bit further down the road.
All right, well, we'll meet somewhere in the middle. So we're going to be talking about video games. We're going to be talking about what we've been playing lately. We're going to be talking about retro games in our gaming opinions on old school funware, aka Goof. We're going to be talking about a personal favorite of mine, Die Hard Trilogy. And then in our feature game, we're going to be talking about Disco Elysium, everyone's favorite game of the past 5 years. Then we're going to engage in some shameless hyping of upcoming titles, what we call Shout.
Yes, of course.
Yes. What have you been up to lately?
So I am currently playing Bay Farm. Ever since we wrapped up Luma Island, I've been wanting to find another cozy game to play with my friend Kate. So I asked around some friends and they suggested some stuff. So I got her a couple games for Christmas, one of them being Bay Farm. So I've played probably 12 hours of it with her over the last week. And there's a lot you can do. It's a very typical farm game where you can like plant and harvest fruit and vegetables, raise farm animals, plant flowers. You can also go fishing and catch bugs and small animals, go into the mines to get ore, which you need to upgrade your tools. You can fight monsters. In this case, the monsters are actually like regular objects that have been affected by wild magics, and they're called jumbles, I guess. Not very intimidating, but that's what it is.
So they are refugees from Wildermyth called jumbles.
Yes.
Okay.
Like one of them is like a spinning... it looks like, oh my god, what's the wheel that's on ships that you turn?
Captain's wheel, I guess?
Yeah. God, isn't there, like, a name for it? Anyway, it doesn't matter. There's one of those, it spins around and it hits you. There's, like, a pocket watch that'll bite you, a book that'll, like, close on you. It's weird, but anyway, you beat them up with your magic staff. And it's been really fun. So it has a story, which isn't great, but it's not bad. And it kind of gives you a goal so you can keep moving along with the game. There's a lot of job quests. It's not like Luma Island, where the only reason to do job quests is to make stuff that you only send for money. So I like that. The end goal of the job, or not the end goal, but the reward for doing all of the job quests is you get a cute job-related outfit. So you can get like a chef outfit if you do the cooking stuff. But It's cute and fun. The economy is a little weird. I don't think I figured it out yet, because in, for example, Stardew Valley, you can make a load of money just by farming. You can harvest your blueberries or whatever and sell them for
mayonnaise.
Yeah, huge amounts of money. In this game, farming doesn't seem very lucrative. You have a limited number of slots that you can put in the market every day, and it just feels like the only thing that I can do is go into the farm, get gems, put them in the gem polisher, and then sell the polished gems, because those sell for significantly more than any of the vegetables I've been able to grow. So I haven't quite figured that out yet. Maybe that's just what you're supposed to do, but it's a little funny, because then when the day rolls over and it tells you how much money you made by, you know, fishing, farming, blah, 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 I always have like 8,000 gold in other. So it's a little weird. It doesn't feel like that's what they intended, but maybe it is. But yeah, that's what I've been up to lately.
It's interesting to hear that there's some issue of broader structure, because we received some, shall I say, irate, verging on angry feedback after our brief discussion of Factorio, that apparently Factorio does have an overarching goal, and the fact that you didn't emphasize it enough is a source of great consternation for some people.
Yes, it is terrible. My own husband was upset with me. He hasn't even played the game. I guess he just looked it up on Wikipedia. But listen, I joined a game that somebody else started. I don't read things, apparently. So it is what it is.
I don't read things. It is what it is. That's great. So listening to the setup of Fae Farm, I'm going to ask the same question I always ask. It's coming.
Okay. Yeah.
Because your explanation of the setup was almost identical word for word for how I would describe Stardew Valley.
Yeah.
You can go into a dungeon and fight some monsters, you can farm some stuff, and you can fish. Of course you can fish. So other than the graphical style, which I confess is not as cutesy as I was expecting, given that it's called Fae Farm, are there any significant differences, or is it just another iteration of the same thing? And again, just to stress, I like beat-em-ups and I like fighting games. I'm always willing to play another instance of the same thing.
It's basically another instance of the same thing. Like, honestly, the main difference that I can think of right now is that there is an actual quest line for the main story, which there's a goal that you're reaching toward in Stardew Valley as well. It's just not quite as structured with the quest line, as I recall. But yeah, there's the quest line, and also you can unlock fairy wings that let you double jump, and double jump is fun. I think that those are the main two differences that I can think of right now.
Sounds legit.
Yeah.
That, and there certainly seems to be some sort of challenge on the Steam page to see how often they can use the word cozy without using it twice sequentially in the same sentence.
Yeah, the cozy game market is funny, because you know when somebody is really trying to emphasize how cozy things are, because it is in every sentence, maybe every other sentence, that they're trying not to like be too harsh with it, but it's a little intense. It's like, okay, it's a farm game. We know it's not going to be like super tense, probably. I can't think of a single farm game like that. But anyway, yeah.
Look, all that I know is that the moment you start looking under the surface of some of the aspects of Stardew Valley in particular, what is revealed is this yawning chasm of horror and bizarreness. Just to pick one thing in particular. And there's literally half a dozen instances of things of this nature that I've heard, and I've never played Stardew Valley. This is all second and third hand. The whole idea of abandoning your children and then they turn into birds and leave, that's deeply messed up, okay? Messed up. So I can definitely understand how, I'm not saying that Fae Farm is desperately trying to signal that it's not messed up like Stardew Valley. But I could appreciate that a number of games are definitely trying to communicate that, like, don't worry. No spoilers, but there's nothing in here that's going to alarm you or upset you or make you think. And I have to emphasize, I just want to make something perfectly clear. I am not being pejorative about this in any way.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
We culturally are reacting to a generational trauma And so the fact that there's been an explosion of cozy games in the past few years does not shock me at all.
Yeah.
And further to which, this is a form of entertainment that doesn't always have to challenge you. It can be just escapist, and so I'm perfectly happy that there are lots of cozy games. It's just, I agree with you, it's a little amusing how overt they are about the vibe.
Yeah, they are not trying to hide it at all. It is their maybe only marketing point that they want to get across most of the time. So yeah, that's... is what it is, I guess.
It's definitely being pitched as an elaboration on Stardew Valley. Like, they don't use the terms Stardew Valley anywhere on the page, but all of it is, yeah. Like, the overall inference that I'm getting, both from your description and what I'm seeing in the marketing materials, is we know the formula. The formula is very well established. We're not messing with the formula. We are iterating on it, and we are going to just make improvements here and there where we think it's possible so as to let you do that thing that you know you want to do, but perhaps in a slightly better way.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, for me, like, I mean, I played tons of Stardew Valley, not nearly as much as some other people, but I, you know, played through the whole game a couple of times. I had a couple multiplayer games going, and it was really fun. But yeah, sometimes I guess starting up Fae Farm and being able to do things in a slightly different way in a different game feels different than loading up Stardew Valley again. And for some people, I know, like, Stardew Valley is brilliant. I think they did everything pretty much perfectly. I played Harvest Moon back in the day, and I cannot say how thrilled I was that I found this, you know, Stardew Valley. Everybody found Stardew Valley. It's, you know, I think everyone knows what Stardew Valley is almost.
Yeah.
But they executed on that formula so well. But it's, you know, every now and then it's nice to go do something else. Some people just want to do the perfect example of the formula, which maybe is or is not Stardew Valley. I think it's pretty up there. But yeah, I'm not one of those people. I like to do other stuff every now and then too, even if it might not be as good or is a little different in ways that I might not like as much. But it's getting to do something else.
And how's the co-op in Fae Farm?
It's good. It's fun. The worst part is that it seems like I need to be able to actually invite my friend every time I want to play. I really wish that she could just join when I have it open. And I don't know if you can actually run a server like you can in some of these games, so she can't play unless I'm playing. I have not actually looked into that very much, so it's very possible that this is a thing. That's the one downside is it can be a little bit clunky, but in general, it's been good. We've been able to both do quests. It's not like other games where I feel like I'm missing out on quests because I don't see the text. Somebody else completed it, and it's all gone. And
good stuff. And that is Fae Farm.
What have you been up to lately?
What I've been up to is I've been playing a game called Redacted. Now, this is a game that showed up on the Epic Games Store end of year game a day spectacular. And some games that show up for free, I claim and never think about them again. But Redacted was already on my Steam wishlist. I had considered possibly giving money for this product. And so when it showed up for free, I was very happy. And indeed, this is a game that was released in just a few months ago this year. And so it's great to be able to get stuff like this unexpectedly for free. Similarly, I would point out that during this period, sadly, it's already passed, but they were giving Sifu away for free, which I maintain is one of the best games I played this year. And I didn't play it the year that it was released, but a spectacular offering and definitely worth $0.00. Now, I realize that many people have strong objections to the Epic Games Store. I respect that. But I can't help but notice once again that the rage at video game distribution channels is often very, very selective in that people are willing to forgive Valve for any number of exploitive monopolistic practices just because Valve offers a slicker product. And yeah, I'm not going to defend Epic Games in particular, but if they want to give me a free game, I'll take it. So I have been playing Redacted. Now, Redacted is a twin-stick roguelike action game. And so sure enough, very much like Fae Farm, it is another instance of the thing. Now, I will say, however, that the structure is great. One of the things that they do in Redacted is there are these rivals. The story of the game is that you're all racing to try to get to an escape pod after a science fiction prison colony gets infected with some sort of version of zombie virus. And so awesome. A whole bunch of people are all racing at the same time. And so later on, it doesn't start like this, but it gradually elaborates as you do more and more runs. There are three other people that are racing to the escape pod at the same time you are. And they can mess with you during your runs. You can mess with them during their runs. You might have some mini-boss fights with them, with some possibility. possibility of fighting them off or possibly even killing them or them killing you. And the biggest thing that this does is that it introduces a fair amount of personality to the adversaries that you're fighting. And more importantly, it introduces a time pressure that feels organic, even though that it isn't. Because if they get to the escape pod before you do, you lose, flat. And it's very, very artificial. It's very rubber bandy. Like, in the early parts of a run, they're going to be listed as ahead of you. And in the later parts of a run, you have to be taking your sweet time for them to still be ahead of you. But whatever. It makes me feel like there's a certain amount of tension, but at the same time, I don't feel panicky the way that some time pressure does. And so I really appreciate what they've done with this Rivals-type structure. It's really excellent. The overall tone of Redacted is also pretty good. So it takes place in the same universe as a game called the Callisto Protocol. These are all games that were published by the same publisher as PUBG. I am not a PUBG guy. I'm not a Fortnite guy. That's not my bag. I don't play games like that. But I will say that the tone of the Callisto Protocol, which is very serious science fiction horror, is very far removed from Redacted. You could just not know that this was in the same universe as the Callisto Protocol, and you would miss nothing. Because in point of fact, it's much more lighthearted. It's actually a very comic book sort of style. If anything, the closest game, it's not quite a good match, but it reminds me an awful lot of the aesthetics of Hi-Fi Rush. Because of the cartoony style, because of the color palette, because of the overall sort of sarcastic tone, it's a little harsher in terms of its science fiction trappings, but it doesn't take itself too seriously. And every time your character gets hit, you hear an electric guitar off-key twang. And so I end up feeling that it's an awful lot like some of the aesthetics of Hi-Fi Rush. It's strange. The one problem that I have with Redacted, and it's a minor one, is that the upgrades are kind of meh. The actual things that you unlock over the course of a given run aren't nearly as interesting as a lot of the other ones. I mean, I will always point to Risk of Rain and Hades as being good examples of things where not all of them feel like earth-shaking upgrades, but some of them are really impressive. And lots of non-roguelike games or pseudo-roguelike games, like even Vampire Survivors knows that if you're going to have upgrades, sometimes you want to make them feel like they're filling the screen with awesomeness. And Redacted never really gets to that. The upgrade pool is relatively small, and they're relatively unimpressive. However, that is compensated for by the fact that the overall broader structure of, I talk about this all the time, the structure of the roguelite upgrades, the upgrades you get that persist between runs or the stuff you buy in between runs, is very, very, very well done. There's a lot to explore, not enough weapons, but a lot of other things to unlock, purchase, and play with. And one thing that's shockingly simple and straightforward, and now I just wish that every game of this ilk would do, you comment on the economy of Fae Farm. Every video game now has economies that you need to figure out. Obviously, free-to-play games and roguelite games are particularly convoluted by design. One of them so as to extract your money, and another so as to allow for lots of different kinds of upgrades. But it can be kind of daunting. I don't want to have to internalize a new kind of macro economy every time I play a game. And Redacted helps you out because everywhere where you can buy anything, it's all very simple. It's like, this is where you buy new outfits and it costs this currency. And that's just the tooltip that's hovering over the place where you buy these things. I'm, oh, okay, this currency uses for that. So everything, every time you have to go buy something or anytime you can upgrade something, the type of thing that it is and the currency that it uses is very clearly associated. And so it took me about half a second to figure out what meant what. And that was just a big, big help for approaching it for the first time. And even really well-done games like Hades, it has a lot of different currencies, and it's not typically very good at disambiguating what does what. And I start forgetting what darkness does as opposed to Blood of Titans or whatever. But in Redacted, it's no problem because they're very, very clearly done. I think it's the way they've approached things structurally from a roguelite is extraordinarily well done and is one of the reasons why I keep coming back for more.
That's awesome. So you said that you have rivals. Are they just on the map with you, or how does that work? Like, can you find them and kill them, or?
So there's this bar at the bottom of the screen that shows up between rooms. The overall room structure is not entirely unlike Hades. There's a combat room. It may be a couple screens wide or so, some bigger, some smaller. And then at the end, you can pick which door to go through, and it's going to tell you what reward is on the other side of the door. And anytime you need to pick a new room between combat encounters, there's this bar that shows where you are, and it shows the escape pod at the far right-hand side of the screen, and it shows the icons of the three other people that are trying to get out of the complex, and they're making their own progress. Over the course of the game, they might start smack-talking you. You know, they'll just talk to you over some hypothetical comm, I guess. Okay. And they're all caricatures. Like, there's the lunch lady that has gone insane. There's Bob from accounting, who's now half a zombie, and so he's a really, really nice and bland guy, but he's also a zombie, so there's that. And they'll, you know, talk about what's going on in their run, or they'll talk smack to you. If they're ahead of you nominally in this progress bar, they can start throwing on additional difficulty modifiers to various rooms you have, and you have the ability to throw difficulty modifiers onto them on a cooldown. And so every once in a while, you can pull this up, and it's sort of like a quick time button combination to mess with them, either delay their progress or just do outright damage to them. Now, why would you do outright damage to them? Well, because every once in a while, one of the possibilities, or sometimes a forced encounter, is a mid-boss encounter with one of your surviving rivals. And they're pretty tough-ish, but they get less tough if you unlock information about them on the personnel records, which is another kind of reward you can get. It's another kind of progression. It's another kind of reward, another kind of element of the roguelite structure. And so it's really neat. And it's not a huge deal. I'm not going to say that it's a massive amount of personality or I care a whole lot about any of these characters. Some of them I find more annoying than others, which I think is kind of the point. They're meant to be obnoxious and annoying.
Yeah.
Because they're just messing with you. That's the only salient way that they can interact with you. But it makes it a lot more engaging when I feel like I've got a time pressure and when I feel like there's actually a cast of antagonists rather than an endless horde of mobs. It's not entirely unlike the way Thanatos would sometimes show up in Hades and just be like, hey, I'm here to mess with you. And be like, oh, hey, Than, let's go have this challenge. Or the way sometimes even some of the specific gods in Hades would get angry because you picked the boon of a different god and they would introduce a difficulty modifier for the current room, right? Those encounters were neat. They kind of broke up the repetitiveness and they give a tiny bit of personality to the proceedings. And Redacted does it in that way. And it's just a core feature of every run now that there's going to be this group of people that's doing the runs with me. And it doesn't influence every combat encounter, but it does encourage me to keep the pace up, which is good in and of itself.
Nice. That sounds pretty cool.
I'm very pleased. I wasn't expecting a whole lot, frankly, and I'm extraordinarily pleased with what I got. The structure makes me want to keep going back, and I wish that there were a few more weapons, and I wish there were a few more interesting upgrades, but like I said, the overall meta structure of how it proceeds is well done enough that I'm willing to forgive it those minor problems, and it is absolutely worth what I paid for it. That is Redacted.
Nice. Okay, we can move on to our gaming opinions on old school funware segment, aka Goof, where we're going to be talking about the Die Hard trilogy on PlayStation. Mark, why don't you take us away?
So it's the early days of the PlayStation, Caitlin, and I don't know if you remember this, but there was what I consider to be a golden age of the demo disc.
Okay.
Because eventually, back when there were still gaming magazines, eventually there was this period of sort of excess where it was no longer a free demo disc. It was every issue had a demo disc and they were charging you $20 for the magazine. And it's clearly now what you were doing was you were buying a demo disc, right? But before that happened, for a few years before that, every once in a while you'd get this demo disc and it'd have some things to play around with. And it was great. I remember very early on at the launch of the PlayStation, there were a series of demo discs. One of them I had. I only had one of them. And it had the first level of Die Hard 2 in the Die Hard trilogy.
Okay.
And it had a couple of other bits. It had some Twisted Metal. It had this. It didn't have any Tekken on it, but there was a video, a compilation video, that showed King doing the giant swing. And that definitely made me want to play Tekken. And I played the crap out of Die Hard trilogy on that disc, and then when the game itself was released, it became a perennial rental, and to this day, it is a game that I play all the time on all my emulation devices. Normally, I maintain this is true. I don't think I'm motivated often by nostalgia Like, mm-hmm. I don't want my devices to look like how another device looked like. You know, there's this somewhat new release called the Ambernic 34XX, which it looks exactly like the first-gen Game Boy Advance. And everyone's going okay. nuts over it. And my response is, okay. It looks like it looks like the thing that you used to have. That's yeah. great. What'll it do for... all right. I will freely admit that this has exceptions. Die mm-hmm. Hard Trilogy may be one of them. Like, I have no objectivity with respect to Die Hard Trilogy. I cannot tell you whether it is as good as I think it is, because I adore the game. I've been playing it for over 25 years.
Yeah.
And it's three games in one, hence trilogy. There's Die Hard, which is a third-person shooter. There is Die Hard 2, which is a on-rail shooter slash light gun thing. I've never played it with a light gun. I've never played any PlayStation-era game on a light gun that was okay. not in the arcade.
Me either.
I have a Sinden light gun. Someday I'm going to find out how it works with RetroArch. And I'm going to hook it up to my arcade cabinet. I'm going to play Time Crisis and do all those things. And it's going to be great. But that day has not come yet. And then there's Die Hard with a Vengeance, a.k.a. Die Hard 3, which is sort of an action racer. Reviews at the time, broadly speaking, because again, when it was released, I was very much looking forward to it. Reviews at the time were like, these games can't really stand on their own, but collectively it's an amazing package. Mm-hmm. I disagree. I like all three of them. I think they're awesome. What do you think, Caitlin?
Okay, so I didn't really know what to expect with Die Hard Trilogy at first because, I mean, granted, so I didn't look up anything about it. I was just like, Die Hard Trilogy, wait, were there like three games released previously? And then, no. So it's just Die Hard Trilogy. That's it. That's all there is. So I played a bit of all three. So the first one, again, there's no tutorial, but I didn't look at the manual or anything. I just kind of figured stuff out as I went along. Took me a little while to realize that the south button is shoot. But once I figured that out, things got a little bit better.
I don't mean to give you a hard time. How long did it take you to figure that out? Like, you've only got four tries. I mean,
well, not only four tries, because I also was using the shoulder buttons and I accidentally threw bombs the first few attempts that I made.
Sure. Or grenades. Okay, but look, I'm very curious here, because if you're not I'm going to assume. So look, I know for a fact that you're an intelligent, competent, qualified individual. And you're familiar with video games. No, I'm not joking. This is like table stakes. This is obvious. So like, you press R1 mm-hmm. and John McClane shuffles to the right. Do you then seriously think that maybe L1 is shoot?
Oh, hang on. Which one was bomb then?
Okay, you can throw grenades in Die Hard's 1 and 2. Die Hard 2 is the first person shooter, first person perspective where you can shoot rockets and or throw grenades. In the first Die Hard, it's a third-person shooter. You see John McClane, you can strafe and you can dodge roll, and he's got grenades, sure, but he doesn't shoot rockets in that one.
Yeah. No, it was... Which one was throwing grenades?
Square,
okay. Yeah, so, I mean, the first couple guys I ran into, I threw grenades, because I didn't realize that he even had a gun. I was like, do I need to punch things? Anyway, it doesn't matter. Ultimately, okay. I got there. I thought it was a very good thing that John McClane is an expert bomb diffuser, because after killing all of the hostages, I shouldn't kill the hostages. After killing all of the terrorists,
Caitlin, you don't need a tutorial to tell you that you shouldn't kill the hostages. Were you killing all the hostages, Caitlin?
No.
How many hostages did you vaporize from a hand grenade? Tell me the truth.
Zero.
Good for you.
I didn't kill any hostages in Die Hard 1. In Die Hard 2, that changed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In Die Hards 2 and 3, you are going to be killing a lot of innocent people. Oh, my goodness.
So many. Oh, my God. So, yeah, it's... So, after you kill the last terrorist, then all of a sudden the bomb is there, and you have to go run and find the bomb. And I made it there with 3 seconds left, and then the level was over. Apparently, I instantly defused it and went up to, you know, the next level, because I guess you start in the garage, and then you make your way up Nakatomi Plaza Tower.
Absolutely. There were only two things that I felt compelled to tell you. I wasn't going to tell you to read the manual, because for what it's worth, I never read the manual. I think I read the manual for the first time like 2 or 3 years ago, frankly.
Okay.
I had just, you know, picked things up by experimentation as well. And the one thing that I told you about Die Hard 1 was that the select button will change the zoom level on your map, because
yes.
if you know that you have 30 seconds to find the exit at the level or you're going to lose, and the exit isn't showing up on your level of zoom at the map, things can get real hard. And let me tell you, playing Die Hard Episode 1 on the PlayStation for years, not knowing that little trick made things extraordinarily unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, it shows up as a little blip, but like you said, if that blip's not on the map, you're just running around aimlessly, hoping that you find it in the next 30 seconds.
Yeah, it's rough.
Yeah. So that was fun. I wasn't as into that one. If I had to choose between the three, Die Harder, the second one, was definitely my favorite.
Okay.
It was so fun. That was also the first time I realized, these are three, they're just doing different mechanics for each of these. Because I wasn't sure if, the first one being a third-person shooter, if that was only part of it. No. So, anyway, Die Harder, that one's, on rails. I have a lot of very fond memories of the first game that I played on rails that I can remember. I'm sure there were ones before, but it was Typing of the Dead.
Oh, yeah.
Which I loved. So this one just brought back some of those fuzzy Typing of the Dead memories.
Typing of the Dead is boss.
I really enjoyed that the first time I accidentally shot a civilian, I said, whoops, and then whoops appeared on screen in text. Yeah. It's like, oh, yeah, whoops.
There is a grim, violent sense of humor that pervades Die Hard Trilogy, the game.
Yeah.
That is absolutely in keeping with the tone of some aspects of the movies that I very much appreciate.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you can mercy kill a guy in the first episode, or the first game, I guess, in Die Hard, by shooting the people that are on fire. So, interesting. Yes. But yeah. And then Die Hard with the Vengeance, the driving one. That one I wasn't really into.
Oh.
I probably didn't give it enough time.
Is that some sort of elaborate meta joke about how the game works? Because...
No,
it's
but...
It's this really interesting racing structure that I haven't seen repeated in many other games, frankly. You're operating under a time limit, and very much like the movie, you're driving around in a taxi trying to find various bombs. It's weird. It is deliberately vague-ish as to how to get from point A to point B. You're given a lot of guidance, both from the radar and front... Well, not a radar. It's more like a series of arrows. And the expostulations of your co-driver, someone who is in the process of trying to sort of almost, but definitely doesn't sound at all like Samuel L. Jackson from Die Hard 3, who tells you to turn right, turn left. I think it's a really interesting structure, and I wish more driving games would adopt structures like that. I mean, mostly checkpoint-based driving games kind of went out of favor when arcades died, because that's how arcades used to do things. It's like, oh, you haven't reached the checkpoint, your playtime is over, done. And often that's kind of silly when it's just, you haven't reached the kind of threshold, so this Daytona-themed race game means you're done, but the race is still going, what? But in the context of Die Hard 3, the city blows up, and that makes sense.
So... this is going to sound silly, but your co-driver or the passenger seat guy, whatever, he's telling you to do things?
Yes.
I instantly tuned him out. That's terrible.
Okay. That's legit. That's fine. He'll tell you turn left up here, turn right over there. Because again, in the context of the movie, Samuel L. Jackson was the one telling Bruce Willis's character where to go.
Yeah.
But I think this is as good a time as any to ask the question, how much enthusiasm do you have for the Die Hard movies, Caitlin?
I love one. I watch it every year. Most recent watch was, of course, I think Christmas Day.
Sure.
I enjoy two. I don't know if I've ever seen three.
I think amongst my cohort, which is to say white cis middle-aged dudes, I may be the person on earth with the least enthusiasm for Die Hard anywhere. It's practically a joke how much people love Die Hard.
Yeah.
Not just people like me, but all kinds of people. Die Hard's fine. I'm okay with it. Honestly, I have more enthusiasm for the Die Hard trilogy game than I do for the Die Hard movies. But I will say I have a certain degree of enthusiasm for Die Hard 3.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's I don't think it's any kind of hidden gem of action movies or anything like that, but I vaguely remember what's going on. And I think it's worth emphasizing, in the context of Die Hard Trilogy, I don't think I have ever heard a worse impression of the guy trying to sound like Bruce Willis in Die Hard Trilogy, except for the guy trying to sound like Samuel L. Jackson in Die Hard with a Vengeance and Die Hard Trilogy. It is literally comical how bad the line deliveries are.
I was really enjoying how bad they were in some, through all of them. You know, the first one, they kept calling John McClane a cowboy in Die Harder. Actually, Die Harder. I don't remember Die Harder having voice. But, you know, the not John McClane saying yippee-ki-yay when you beat a level in the first one. Like, that, it was all just very silly and fun. I was into it.
The silliest aspect, I think, that still sticks with me, and it's one of the reasons why Die Hard Trilogy was banned in a number of jurisdictions, mm-hmm. was because if you run... Sorry, not if. When you run innocent people over in Die Hard with a Vengeance,
yeah,
the default camera perspective, and you can change it, but it's not a good idea to, is first person. And so blood splatters all over the windshield, and then the windshield wipers turn on.
Yeah.
And it's so grim and terrible, and I love it every time.
Yep. Yeah, I was shocked, honestly, the first time I ran into somebody and it actually, like, blood splattered and then the windshield wiper started going. I was like, oh, that's what kind of game this is.
Yeah, I love it. I don't even know which one of the three games I could say I prefer. I like them all that much. Mm-hmm. And I'm not normally a rail shooter kind of guy. Like, I haven't even played Virtua Cop, frankly. I should give that a try someday.
Yeah.
I don't even know how it would work with a light gun, but it works pretty well with the reticle that you move around with your controller, I have to say.
Yeah, it's not bad. And I was honestly surprised by how precise I was able to be, even just with, you know, I was just using a D-pad to move it around. And yeah, it wasn't bad. I shot significantly fewer hostages than I expected to.
Which is to say, not zero.
I knew it was inevitable.
Yeah, that's the best attitude. It is more possible to play the first game without murdering hostages, but in Die Hards 2 and 3, it is practically... Well, 3, I'd be shocked if anyone can play 3 without running over a substantial number of people.
Yeah.
Well, I guess even 1 is a substantial number of people, but even Die Hard 2, I'd be very surprised if anyone could get through that without accidentally shooting a phantom.
Oof. I mean, in 3, the number of people who are jaywalking, it's like, hey... Calm down. Isn't this New York City? Like, stop doing this.
You'd think they'd be better at jaywalking. I come from Montreal. Jaywalking is an art. And yes, they are bad at jaywalking. But that's just part of the game design. And for what it's worth, hostages being difficult not to shoot is also just deliberately part of the level design in Die Hard 2 because the terrorists are using mm-hmm. them as human shields.
Yeah.
And so it's an extra shooting challenge of trying to hit them without hitting the hostages. I have such enthusiasm for Die Hard Trilogy. It is one of the first things I always load up onto any emulation device. And it is, I think, tragically underappreciated amongst people who go back through the PlayStation catalog. And part of it, I think, has to be because the sequel, Die Hard Trilogy 2, was such hot garbage. It was real, real bad. It just did not know how to play to its strengths. Like, in theory... Structurally, it should be fine. The idea was we're going to tell like a new story and we're going to have some third-person shooter levels. We're going to have some driving levels. We're going to have some on-rail shooting levels.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is just they didn't capture the mechanical magic of Die Hard Trilogy. Like, none of the sequences work as well. And part of it is also that the pacing was off and that the sequences were all a little bit too long. And part of it was also just that the new story was garbage and didn't make a whole lot of sense. But the magic was gone. They couldn't recreate it.
In Die Hard Trilogy 2, was that a new story that was only for the game, or was it... Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was an original story for the game. It was some incredibly strange... kind of, they were trying to tell a secret agent story kind of sort of thing. Maybe almost... It was straight... I do not recommend Die Hard Trilogy 2.
Okay.
But Die Hard Trilogy 1 is one of my favorite PlayStation games, and I've played a lot of different PlayStation games. I'm such a fan. I'm glad you enjoyed parts of it.
I'd never heard of Die Hard Trilogy as a PlayStation game, so that was pretty cool. Not that I knew about like every PlayStation game that came out, because no, but it was fun getting to try something brand new.
Well, I'm glad you're able to enjoy part of it, and that it is not purely my nostalgia talking in terms of my enthusiasm for Die Hard Trilogy.
Yes, definitely not purely the nostalgia.
So that is your blast from 1996, Die Hard Trilogy by Probe Entertainment of the PlayStation. There was also a Saturn version. I do not recommend it. PlayStation version is where it is at. So we are now going to take a brief break and hear from our sponsors.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Welcome back. We're going to jump to our feature game now, Disco Elysium. Apparently, we're doing cop games this time around.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah. Yeah, I literally just realized that when you were talking about Die Hard. I was like, wait.
It is strange how often we have unintentional themes.
I know. For what's going on.
The one about a corrupt and corruptible afterlife process from last week truly blew my mind. That was entirely accidental, as was this one. And in Redacted, you play as a prison guard. So even there.
Yeah.
Corrections officers broadly construed. There you have it.
So in Disco Elysium, you play a detective named something. You don't really remember your
name.
Question
mark?
So when I was replaying, I was like, oh, I'm sure Mark was thrilled that the game starts off and you're amnesiac. But this is actually one game where I thought, like, I really liked it. I usually don't.
Specifically the amnesiac part.
Yeah. Honestly, it takes you some time to even remember that you're a cop. You don't know what year it is. You partied real hard the night before and have forgotten pretty much everything. Thankfully, your brand new partner, Kim, shows up and he helps you out, helps, you know, kind of lay out what's going on. There is a dead body that's been hanging in the backyard of the inn that you're staying at for the last week. And apparently you probably have been doing something with that or should have been doing something with that. So, Mark, what have you been thinking about Disco Elysium?
So I've been meaning to play Disco Elysium ever since it came out. It has been getting rave reviews since its inception. Not too long ago, it got basically a new definitive version with a bunch more voice acting. And it seems like a strange place to start, but I do really want to emphasize how good the voice acting is.
It is
truly, truly remarkable. The final cut was the definitive edition that introduced a whole bunch more voice acting. And Lenville Brown is the name of sort of the narrator who narrates not just the background information, but a lot of the interior dialogue of the main character.
Yeah.
And he's legit brilliant. I think it's the best voice acting performance I've heard in years.
So good. The first time I played this game, Disco Elysium, was before the final cut, unfortunately. The final cut came out within 6 months of me playing. But I was playing it this last week, and I honestly couldn't imagine what the game was like without him. Like, really good.
In all senses of the word voice, I cannot imagine Lenville Brown as being anything other than the voice of Disco Elysium.
Yeah.
It is such an emblematic performance that it sets the entire tone of everything that transpires in the game. And it's utter genius. And they spent a lot of time and a lot of effort doing all the voice acting in-house. Mm-hmm. Lenville Brown worked with him for 8 months doing all this work. And as somebody who's done voice acting before, that's a long time. And I can understand why they wanted to do it, because they're very... I don't want to sound dismissive or resentful, I can understand why they'd want to be very precious or very protective of their writing. Because mm-hmm. this is very much a game made by and for people who like writing.
Yeah.
Of a very particular style. Part of the problem is that the writing style is not one that I like. But it is exceptionally well done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my overall impression of Disco Elysium, for what it's worth, is that this is a work of genius that I don't have any interest in. And so like, when, you know, going back, I keep going back as a touchstone. When I play the Zelda games, I'm like, I kind of see what people like about this, but I'm not really there. When I played Undertale, I'm like, I don't understand what people see in this. And I, you tried to bring me there, and I think I got some insight, but I didn't already get there. Disco Elysium, like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. The quality just screams everywhere. It's so exceptionally well done. I don't really want much to do with it. Not in a sort of disgust way. This is not like me reacting to Nabokov's Lolita, right? Where it's like, ugh, gross, because that was the point. The point of Lolita was that it was gross. But so this, it's not that I find it repellent in that sense. It's just a whole bunch of stuff that I don't really have much interest in. I don't know if you're a Neil Gaiman fan, Caitlin.
Well, that's a loaded question nowadays. I used to
Okay,
be.
Sorry. Yeah. You're entirely right. I don't know if you've appreciated the works of Neil Gaiman in the past, Caitlin.
I have in the past, yes.
So have I, but when I was consuming some of the writing of Disco Elysium, there's a passage of Gaiman's that is very famous and is often quoted that immediately came to mind. Mm-hmm. With your indulgence, I'd like to read part of it just to express what's going on. So this is from Anansi Boys. Fat Charlie was thirsty. Fat Charlie was thirsty and his head hurt. Fat Charlie was thirsty and his head hurt and his mouth tasted evil and his eyes were too tight in his head and all his teeth twinged and his stomach burned and his back was aching in a way that started around his knees and went up to his forehead and his brains had been removed and replaced with cotton balls and needles and pins, which was why it hurt to try and think. And his eyes were not just too tight in his head, but they must have rolled out in the night and been reattached with roofing nails. And now he noticed that anything louder than the gentle Brownian motion of air molecules drifting softly past each other was above his pain threshold. Also, he wished he were dead. That writing is virtuosic. It's writerly. It's show-offy in the best possible way.
Mm-hmm.
This is someone playing with words and language, and I don't like it. It's just not my style. It's not something I appreciate. Yeah. And that passage, I've heard several different people unconnected to each other cite that passage as an example of Neil Gaiman's writing in a positive context.
Yeah.
And I've enjoyed some Neil Gaiman stuff in the past, not his alleged abuses, but some of his writing. I love The Sandman. Anyway, when playing Disco Elysium, I kept thinking of this passage.
Mm-hmm.
And not just because of the style. So do you agree with me that there's some superficial stylistic similarities between us? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Also because, and I think this is important to disclose right at the outset, because a lot of the subject matter of Disco Elysium I find aggressively uninteresting.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the amnesia. Absolutely, that's part of it. And I want to be very, very clear here. I have endless sympathy for people who struggle with addiction. I've got members of my family that struggle with addiction. I have no interest in stories about people grappling with alcoholism. I just don't. I don't find it interesting. And it doesn't help that there is a million and one stories about writers struggling with alcoholism. Do you know why? Because stories are written by writers, and many writers have alcohol problems. And so there's a billion and one, like, it's just endless. And so I feel like I've been there 1,000 times before. And so when I fully internalized the setup of Disco Elysium was an amnesiac who suffers from alcohol-induced amnesia, and not even, it's even worse than that. It's like goes past the point of plausibility, because amnesiacs tend to remember what they do for a living. They tend to remember their skill set. They tend to remember facts about the world. They tend to remember what century it is, right? So part of this is plausible. Part of this is set dressing. Part of this is unreliable narrator. It's meant to do a whole bunch of things that simple amnesia can't shoulder. And I get that. That's fine. I'm willing to give it a certain amount of stretch. So all of that, all that table setting was stuff that is not for Mark. Capital N, capital F, capital M. And it's led me to basically a sort of summary of this is that I am not Disco.
You're not
Disco. Is used in a variety of ways in Disco Elysium to describe it. Whatever it is, it ain't me. I'm not Disco. The sense in which I am Disco is like Bee Gees and John Travolta, and that is not the sense in which Disco Elysium uses the term Disco.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that having been said, I think Disco Elysium is one of the most brilliant games of the past few years. And I don't want to play it.
That's understandable. I mean, so I think the moment that I fell in love with Disco Elysium is I was in the middle of a conversation with somebody and I selected an option and then I got an achievement of sorry cop. Because I was a sorry cop who said sorry all the time. And just, I don't know, the context of it, like with that conversation, me apologizing for something was just like, okay, nope, this game is hilarious. And I'm very much like, I'm also not super into, you know, the story about alcoholism, drug addiction. Like, I'm sure that is interesting for some people. That's definitely, like, I've never been into any of those things, and it's hard for me to, like, I can't really relate. And it's good. It's good that I can't relate with this guy, because he's had a real rough go of it. Honestly, the characters, Kuno is horrible and incredible. Like,
he is described as a goblin, and that is pretty appropriate.
Yeah.
A little monster of a sociopath who refers to himself in the third person and who hates everyone.
The F are you calling a third person? Kuno's the effing first person. That's a quote from him.
Absolutely. Okay, well, that's part of the problem. And part of the reason why I have no difficulty, I think, acknowledging or at least understanding part of Disco Elysium's brilliance.
Yeah.
I, too, earned Sorry Cop as a characterization. This does not surprise me because I'm Canadian, so maybe it sensed that from some broader sense. But there's basically three buckets of interactions you can have in Disco Elysium, given the overall setup and given the overall tenor of it. And for what it's worth, I felt that the game was pushing me into the first bucket. It wanted me through, like, the loading screens and things. The first bucket is Disco, which is to say weird things, have strange conversations, introduce bizarre non sequiturs, just, you know, bounce stuff around, man, play with ideas, whatever. It's all Disco, man. I'm using Disco far more aggressively than the game ever does, but as a way to characterize what's going on, I hope it's at least somewhat evocative. I never felt comfortable doing that a whole heck of a lot because mostly in context, it made me feel like being a jerk.
Yeah.
Which leads me to the second bucket. The second bucket I would squarely put as like Mass Effect Renegade of just literally being a jerk. And then there's the third bucket, which is, look, I'm trying to be as responsible as I can, given that I'm apparently a peace officer trying to solve a murder, and I don't know what is going on in any way.
Yeah. Right?
And that's not a vibe that I none of those three vibes I liked.
Yeah.
None of those three vibes I really enjoyed. And I didn't encounter anyone that wasn't doing any one of those three buckets, largely speaking, with a couple of salient exceptions, those being people my character had desperately wronged during his bender, right? There's a conversation early on with an employee of the hostel. I should say ex-employee of the hostel. It's harrowing. And it really made me not like anything that was going on. It's well done. It's plausible. Yeah. It's evocative and kind of touching in a number of ways. And it even kind of sort of has a bit of a happy ending-ish if you play it that way. There's room for depth and interest in all these things. Like, even Kuno, like, my character, I realized immediately after I said it, my characterization of Kuno is false. He's not a sociopath. He's a gremlin. But he's got a strange sense of, I wouldn't say principle, but there's more going on than what initially appears. But the surface level is all grime and disgusting behavior and obnoxious, grating rudeness. And I wasn't interested in going too much further down there, that rabbit hole. Because there are rabbit holes to be had.
Yeah.
And what's more, what's even more fascinating is, I wish that this engine were used to tell so many more different kinds of stories.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
In a very real way, because we talked last week about different ways to do graphic adventure games.
Mm-hmm.
Right? In the context of both To the Moon, we talked about Grim Fandango. Sort of two ends of it. We also referenced a number of times Telltale games. Disco Elysium has a set of game mechanisms that really shows you how to evolve the genre and play with things in interesting ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I really hope that it is used again for other kinds of stories and other kinds of storytelling.
I completely agree. I feel like, weirdly, a lot of the game doesn't necessarily feel, or at least the mechanics don't necessarily feel super groundbreaking, like when separated from each other. But altogether, it absolutely made this experience that I had never had before, like this way of exploring a narrative. And like, I don't know, it was, my mind was blown the first time I played it. Cause I'm like, wow, you can combine all these things and make something extremely cool.
It's got RPG trappings, you know, your mm-hmm. equipment modifies your stats. It's got skills, it's got various other things, but the relentlessness with which skills influence your character's perspective on the world and the way that it represents his fractured psyche.
Yeah.
It is literally, so look, it is the case that anybody who's studied any amount of psychology or metaphysics or philosophy of mind or anything knows, or even thought about it, is that every person's consciousness is basically a fractious parliament of different ideas and thoughts at any given moment. And we only have the superficial appearance of being of single-mindedness by virtue of the fact that at the end of the day, we have but one corporeal instantiation, one body, and we're going to have to decide what to do with that one body, and so it looks like we just had the one idea. But mm-hmm. that is deceptive because everybody knows that underneath that there's a roiling mass of sometimes quiet, sometimes noisy, but always present, dissenting views and other possibilities. And Disco Elysium says, what if we gave all of those voices?
Yeah.
What if we even personified some of them in articles of clothing? And what if we made different skill sets argue with each other in the context of a single frame of narration? And it's brilliant. But, yeah. And I would argue, like, it lends itself obviously to this person's story, given that his psyche is obviously damaged in a fundamental way. I think it could be done, frankly, for anyone's interior narration, if you wanted mm-hmm. it to. And I wish more games would take this approach.
Yeah, just having, literally getting to see an argument within his head play out. Getting to see, in one instance, I'll be vague, because this could come off as spoilery, but the main character is talking to a woman, and all of a sudden, one part of him pipes up and is like, you're compromised. Like, she's deceiving you. Don't listen to those other guys. And you reply like, what do you mean? I'm confused. Like, okay, fine. Ask him what's going on, blah, blah, blah. And then this other part of him answers and says something completely nonsensical. And you're like, oh, okay. Like, just being able to see that play out is so great. And then having it even acknowledged by the main character, like, I've been sitting here in silence long enough. I should probably say something.
Like I say, the writing chops are here, mm-hmm. and those structural elements are brilliant. The way it's instantiated, again, sometimes in terms of the tone of the prose is not to my taste. But what they were doing with the sort of structure of graphic adventure game, because, like, on the surface, this, you know, the core of this story could have been told in a very, very simple way.
Yeah.
Guy wakes up after a bender, has to solve a murder mystery, doesn't remember anything. Okay, fine. Like, we've seen versions of that. It can be told as basically procedural. But it's not, because they've decided to give voice to all of these different elements, and managing isn't the right word. Navigating the psyche of the main character is, I would argue, most of the game. It's far more salient than the, you know, the petty thing about the dead body.
Yeah.
And the crime that needs to be solved. If anything, that is secondary. Most of it is internal to the main character. And rather than feeling like a pointless distraction to the main plot, it is the main plot, and it's mm-hmm. great. And this, again, I just want to reemphasize, this is internalized mechanically. Not that every great narrative structure needs to be realized mechanically. We've talked a lot about games where there were no mechanical instantiation whatsoever. Still Wakes the Deep wouldn't know a game mechanism if the game mechanism grew five human faces and reached out from the darkness to eviscerate it. But Disco Elysium, you literally start equipping thoughts. You have a thought cabinet, and you equip various thoughts that kind of sort of are like items, kind of sort of are like quests, and are kind of sort of like tasks, and they're what help you navigate what's going on. I use that in the broadest possible term, and you know, this dovetails as well with the skill system, which is remarkably robust and yet superficially evident, which in turn shows up in all of these different dialogues. So it doesn't feel like you're just this massive numbers that's going, there's a fair bit of that. Like, there are skill checks and whatever, and there's that too. Sure, fine.
But the thing that I love about those skill checks is that even when you fail, it's interesting. In Baldur's Gate 3, for example, there were a number of times where I save-scummed the crap out of something because I really didn't want to fail. And of course, I'm sure that happens in Disco Elysium too. But Disco Elysium, every now and then, just seeing a failure that's not necessarily like, oh yeah, the game is over now because something bad is going to happen. No, something interesting happens because all of a sudden the main character makes a fool out of himself because he failed a skill check that let him remember something, for example. And I thought that was a really neat way of handling it. Like, there's loads of skill checks throughout every conversation, and that affects how the conversation goes.
Disco Elysium most of the time does a very, very good job of encouraging you to be experimental and try weird stuff, even if it's going to be embarrassing or humiliating in the context of the main character, in other words, to be Disco. But I will say that the first time I played Disco Elysium, it didn't set me up for that kind of mind frame very well. My first playthrough of Disco Elysium lasted 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I am told by people who play a lot of Disco Elysium is that you can finish the first game, your first playthrough, in much less time than that. Because what happened was I had a whole bunch of internal dialogue. Main character wakes up mostly naked in his trashed hostel room. I literally reached for something, had a cardiac incident, and died.
Yep, that's how my first game ended as well.
Hard game over. Like, that's fine. Like, there's a lot of tonal and thematic and narrative elements that make it so that you might want that possibility to occur. The problem is that it runs at tension with the overall atmosphere that it wants to make of, go and try weird stuff, don't worry about it. Like, if anything, again, talking about graphic adventure games, it made me feel a little bit like the old Sierra graphic adventure games where, and this was the joke that LucasArts made, oh, you died because you tried to pick up something sharp.
Yeah.
Here, I wasn't even trying to pick up something sharp. I was just trying to grab my tie, and that's it. Pfft, dead. Yep. And I half admire it, and the other half is like, you're not really setting me up for...
Yeah.
It helped me get out of the adventurous mindset that I think is the best frame with which to approach Disco Elysium.
I can see that, because all of a sudden you're like, okay, if reaching for a tie killed me, then what else is going to randomly kill me that I'm not expecting? And I think that, I don't think there's a whole lot of other instances like that in the game, but having that be the very first thing you experience definitely could give you a very different impression of how the rest of the game goes. Like, what if you say something weird and this lady pushes you over the balcony and you fall to your death? Like, I don't know, maybe.
Or Kim finally loses his patience and cuts you loose. Like, that I think also was a minor problem for me. Again, personally, I don't think it was a misstep. Kim's role in the story, Lieutenant Kim, is very important, and it's handled very, very well. His voice actor is also outstanding.
Yes.
And he's a great foil for the main character, and it's all great. The problem is, and again, this is my perspective, my inability to get out of myself to really enjoy Disco Elysium and to meet the game halfway. I didn't want to let Kim down. I was tired of embarrassing him and disappointing him.
Yeah.
Because Kim shows up and he's like, look, you're a fellow police officer. I'm going to stick my neck out for you. I'm going to stand next to you, even though you are obviously a buffoon.
Yeah.
Even though you are transparently a degenerate who does not deserve to be wielding any authority or pursue his job and desperately needs help. And Kim is there to give you the last kind of help that the main character needs, right? Mm-hmm. The main character doesn't need to go track down his gun and his badge and get... Like, the main character needs to get his stuff together, that's for sure, but not that stuff and not in that way.
Yeah.
And I get it. That's the story Disco Elysium wants to tell. Disco Elysium wants to tell the story of embarrassing Kim and him having long, tortured sighs and the main character saying weird stuff to some girl he traumatized a couple nights ago.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's a story worth telling. And Disco Elysium tells that story real well. And I am not there for it.
So for what it's worth, I did feel... So granted, okay, I have not finished the game this time around. I'm still somewhere in the first act. But when I beat it before, I did feel that eventually I was able to carve a version of the main character that I wasn't embarrassed to be playing.
Okay.
I don't really know how long it takes to get there, or if I even, I absolutely could be misremembering, but I don't know. I love Kim, and I wanted Kim to be my friend, and I felt very sad every single time I let him down by being an idiot.
Kim's a solid bro. Yeah, that's part of it. One of my first glosses was, again, this is more very, very personal ways that I approached the story. Mm-hmm. I thought, okay, fine. I can work with this. I like redemption stories. I can get this guy back into the straight and narrow insofar as the game will let me, right? And then I kind of felt that the game was judging me for trying to tell that story.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I get the solid sense some of it was the reactions of other characters, some of it was the, you know, the interior narration of the main character, some of it was even loading screen hints.
Yeah.
And again, it was the game telling me, you're not Disco enough. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. I'm not rising to the level of Disco Elysium. I'm not rising to the level of this game. You can probably get the main character to go and like pursue the case and do the thing and be very apologetic and try as best as possible not to let Kim down and follow some regs and not let the other cops get under your skin and be patient with Kuno and.
Yeah.
But I got the solid sense that that wasn't the story that they really wanted me to tell. they would have let me tell it. I got the sense, yeah. But they would have felt a little disappointed in me. And there was only so much disappointment I could take.
Yeah, I think that the first time around I played it very, you know, I just wanted him to be a good person. And I'm not good at being a bad person in video games. I just can't do it. But
same
this
here.
Time I did let myself be a little more Disco. Not particularly Disco. I still wanted Kim to be proud of me because he's my bro.
Yep.
And I even made him proud of me a few times. And that just felt
honestly
so good
for you.
When it did.
Yeah. Just to be clear, Disco Elysium got me far closer than any other game has up to this point of trying to inhabit that sort of Fear and Loathing Las Vegas, Disco, Renegade kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I tried. I tried to get there, but I couldn't. And again, this is one of the reasons why I feel comfortable in saying Disco Elysium is utterly brilliant. Maybe this is even just a headspace thing. I could easily imagine in 6 months or maybe even just 6 weeks coming back and being like, yeah. But as it is, just with the sheer shock of all of the Disco Elysium of it, I was mostly just sort of being recoiling like that piece of art that is trying to disgust you. Unlike my past comments like To the Moon or Before Your Eyes, where like this could have easily been a movie or even Thank Goodness You're Here. I don't think Disco Elysium could have been a movie. No.
No.
But if it had been a movie, I can have movies disgust me. That is fine. My favorite movie of all time is Old Boy. Old Boy has lots of disgusting things in it. There's a certain kind of repellent art that works very well and that I appreciate in lots of contexts. But the specific ways in which Disco Elysium is being very self-consciously repellent, for what it's worth, maybe it's just me now, maybe it's me generally, not the kind of thing I could engage with on its own terms.
Yeah, that's understandable.
But I am hugely impressed. Oh my goodness. I really do want so many more storytelling games to be as mechanically robust and intricate and interesting and self-reinforcing and consciously constructed and deliberately crafted as Disco Elysium is.
Yeah, like even if you take out, I mean, you can't divorce like the setting and the writing from the mechanics necessarily in the way I'm about to say this, but it comes together in such a beautiful package and it works so well. And Disco Elysium could have been, like you said, it could have been very straightforward, not had any of that internal monologue stuff, told exactly the same story on the surface and been garbage, like not good. Like the way that they put it together, just everything, it's beautiful.
So that is Disco Elysium. Originally published in 2019 by ZAUM. We're now going to go on into some shameless hyping of upcoming titles, what we call shout. Caitlin, what would you like to shout out?
So today I'm going to shout out Outer Worlds 2. I very much enjoyed the first entry in the series. I refused to wait until it came off the Epic Games Store, so that's I'm pretty sure the one and only game that I actually own that I paid money for on the Epic Games Store. But I really enjoyed it. Very much looking forward to the second one. I hope in the second one I can design my character from more than just the inventory screen. It's very, very silly how literally the only time you ever see them after the character creation is when you're equipping stuff. But anyway, we'll see how it goes in Outer Worlds too.
Well, that's pretty much part and parcel of a lot of Bethesda games. Now, it wasn't done by Bethesda, it was done by Obsidian. Yeah. But it was very much in the same idiom as the first-person Bethesda games, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I enjoyed the Outer Worlds as well. Like many Bethesda games, I enjoyed it thoroughly and did not finish it. Well, I would like to very hesitantly call attention to Double Dragon Revive. I've said before, beat-em-ups are having a bit of a renaissance. And ever since Streets of Rage 4, which is brilliant, there have been a whole bunch of other beat-em-ups released, like Shredder's Revenge, which is quite good. There's been a G.I. Joe one and a Mighty Morphin Power Rangers one, which apparently are not very good. That's fine. And Double Dragon is arguably one of the very first, not the first, but one of the very first beat-em-up series. And there's going to be a new one designed by Yuke's and Arc System Works. And those are two companies that do a lot of good work. But I have to say what I've seen so far does not inspire any confidence at all.
Uh-oh.
Because it looks kind of generic, and 3D beat-em-ups are super hard to do. And so far, the really successful redesigns have all been 2D. And that's not just a graphical thing, that's also a control thing. I don't think there's really been a super solid 3D beat-em-up other than God Hand and maybe Sifu, if you even want to call it a beat-em-up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's only two in a long history, so... But anyway, Double Dragon Revive. What's between indifferent and cautiously optimistic?
Oh, man. I don't know. I'm not sure what's between those. Really cautiously.
Whatever is between those two things, that's what I am with respect to Double Dragon Revive. There's a lot of talent behind it, at least. The studio and the publisher are both really good and have done good things. We'll see. For what it's worth, I also feel the same way about the upcoming Streets of Rage game that has been teased a number of times, but who knows.
Fingers crossed.
And in that spirit of somewhere between indifference and optimism, thank you so much for joining us for All My Best Friends Are Digital. We hope to see you again soon. If you like what you hear, please do tell a friend. We would love to get more exposure, and not in the way that will get us on more government watch lists. Hope to see you again soon.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in touch, you can reach us at allmybestfriendsaredigital@gmail.com. Hope to see you again soon.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.